to the victims and the families of the victims in the next State of the Union address, which is in August. But there's already a backlash. We already have paramilitary groups calling him a communist, calling him a traitor, talking about impeachment proceedings. So we don't know whether he's seen the film. He received a copy of the film though from a relative of his in his mother's living room, and we have a photograph of him holding the film in his mother's living room.
How many people were killed in 1965, 66, 67 in Indonesia by the Indonesian military and paramilitaries?
Almost certainly more than a million, perhaps up to three.
Oscar-nominated filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer, director of The Look of Silence, which has just been released around the United States. October 1st marks the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the 1965 genocide in Indonesia. Participant media and human rights groups are circulating petitions calling for the United States to declassify and release its CIA, its military, its government, its corporate records about the killings in Indonesia and to acknowledge the U.S. role in the genocide. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is more talk radio with our hosts Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott. Today's guests are Associate Director of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, Sean Tenney, and performing artist Chisao Hata, who are working together towards a nuclear-free world.
Hi, this is John Schott, host of Religion for Life. We all remember Mr. Rogers, the peaceful guy with the sweater and the tennis shoes and Welcome to My Neighborhood. But he was countercultural and a fierce peacemaker. Author Michael G. Long has written Peaceful Neighbor, Discovering the Countercultural Mr. Rogers.
Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine?
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the ever-present nuclear threat, Thursday, August 6th, at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Waterfront Park in Portland. 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki will feature speakers and performers, including Portland Taiko, and will provide opportunities for attendees to get involved in efforts to abolish nuclear weapons. That's 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The ever-present nuclear threat, Thursday, August 6th, 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor along with North Portland Community Building Group, Proper, of the We Can Do It Together community concert. Local politicians, community activists, faith groups, and artists will join in a day of unity, song, and prayer in Kenton Park on Saturday, August 8th from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. This concert will feature a variety of local artists that will rally for unity in this time of unrest. Again, that's the We Can Do It Together community concert, Saturday, August 8th from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Kenton Park at North Kilpatrick and Delaware in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. here in Portland, Oregon. In the metro area, it's 90.7. In parts east along the Columbia River Gorge, you are listening at 91.9. In points south along the Willamette River Valley, it is 104.3. And in the ether, KBOO.FM.
This is More Talk Radio. I'm Cecil Prescott.
I'm Celeste Carey, and it's Monday.
Today is Monday. August, August 3rd, 2015.
Was it a slight hint of fall in the air? Oh, things that, to come?
I hope so.
Oh, what happened to the people who like heat? Heat is good. It allows you to get things out of your system. It's God's natural sauna. Come on, y'all. Sweat out the impurities and the obstructions.
Well, you know, those who are listening in the ether probably have no idea what we're talking about, and probably
we're talking about our three-digit temperatures that I'm loving.
In the meantime, let's talk about let's speak to some people that I think are great, and I'm trying to connect what we just said, segue into warming and
well, no, I was thinking more about the show that had been on before, where we were talking about forms of genocide and the fact that there are landmarks in human experience that we should never forget, that should always be a beacon, should always be a marker to remind us that we not only need to love our fellow human beings, sister human beings, brother human beings, you know, on this planet, but to look at ways which we deal with each other in conflict. And we forget sometimes as human beings that we have the power for ultimate destruction. We forget that. We take things too lightly. And I think it's really important for us to just remember that there is a consequence for unbridled power, unbridled anger, and that what we should be looking at are putting as much energy as we do in retribution to finding that point of forgiveness and ability to work it out, mediation and conversation.
Excellent.
And reconciliation. There we go. Okay, there's your segue.
Hey, thank you so much. So this morning we are focusing on the 70th anniversary of the atomic bombing of two cities in Japan, and what people are doing about to remember those tragic events and how to work together to build a nuclear weapons-free world.
To never go that way again.
Want to introduce our guest?
Yes, I will. We have Sean Tinney, and you are with Physicians for Social Responsibility.
That's correct.
Yes. And then Chisao Hata, who is a performing artist who we've had the pleasure of having on here at least two other times before.
Thank you.
Yes. And so I'm very honored to have you on here to talk about the performances, the shows, and also if people want to talk about how they can get involved in helping us become nuclear free, especially given the fact that we just signed a deal.
Yeah.
We are marketing a deal, let me put it that way. And we haven't signed it yet, but we're marketing it.
Let's see what's happened. So
yes,
let's begin by maybe Sean. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the events that are planned this week.
I'd be happy to. Thanks so much, Cecil. So so Oregon PSR and a group of our community partners, a really great coalition of other peace and justice and Japanese American social organizations here in Portland have organized an event to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's coming up this Thursday, and it's called 70 Years After Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Ever-Present Nuclear Threat. It's going to be on Thursday, August 6th at 6 o'clock from 6 to 7 at the Japanese American Historical Plaza, which is down on the Portland waterfront at Cooch Street. We're very excited for this event. really it is an opportunity for us to commemorate and memorialize the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and remember the tragic loss of life that happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But it's also a chance for us to look forward and say, you know, looking at that example, this horrible thing that happened 70 years ago, but how can we use that now, today in 2015, to work towards a nuclear-free future? So that's really the focus of the event, is both to commemorate the lives lost and to use it as an opportunity to engage people in our work to get rid of nuclear weapons and to do everything we can to limit the spending for these weapons.
And Giselle, could you share something about why are you involved in this effort?
Well, I'm, first of all, Japanese-American, Sansei, third generation. And I get involved with the Hiroshima-Nagasaki memorials in about 1980 and have since then been involved pretty much every year. And in 2013, I had the opportunity to go to Hiroshima and participate in the annual memorial with about 50,000 other people. It was one of those kind of lifetime yearnings that I wanted to be at that place memorializing that day. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to make it to Nagasaki that year. But also, I went because as a Japanese American, we have an important story, and we were telling that story and took that story to Hiroshima. And, you know, the bridges that need to be made between cultures and communities happen in small ways and can happen in bigger ways. But for me, that was a really underscored not only why I've been involved, but why I continue to be involved. The other reason that I've been really deeply involved in the Hiroshima Day and working with PSR and their peace work group is, as a performing artist, I felt it was really important because it's such a, you know, you can only talk about it so much. You mm-hmm. have to move people's hearts and find the place where their humanity is touched. And so I started, I'm not quite sure when, reading poetry and then creating different choreo poems, really theatrical performances with dialogue, poetry, and movement. And some of them became community organizing, community engagement events around it. And other times it's been, you know, poetry, but definitely a lot of performances involved in the programs that PSR does.
Excellent.
You know, when you talk about this, only so much you can talk about it, and you have to find different ways of expression. As years have progressed and you stand here as a beacon for our conscience, what are some of the ways you've had to adapt how you have done your performance to hit that spot of humanity, that hit that heart?
I'm going to kind of answer that in a roundabout.
No, that's okay.
When I went to Hiroshima, you know, of course the memorial and the program itself is amazing, and it starts right before the time that the bomb landed. But it wasn't all the festivities or all the speeches or all the wonderful people that I met or going to some of the churches and schools that we performed in. It was a moment that was right before I went on the, they have a ceremony where you have a lantern and you write an ancestor's name on that lantern or someone you would like to remember, and you float it down the river in memory of the many bodies that were floating down that river 70 years ago. And on my way there, I stopped at the altar that was made, and there were two children, probably about seven, mm-hmm. maybe, standing in front of the altar praying, but also in tears. I mean, their empathy for the situation, of course, it's their country and their, but these are very young people. And so I wondered, like, what and how did their parents talk to them
right.
about this event? you know, what made their feelings so deep?
What made them resonate with something that was two lifetimes before them?
Yeah, exactly. And then I thought about, would our American children, you know, of course, yes, some, but I've been in more situations where parents don't want children to know the bad history, which includes, you know, not only what happened to Japan, but also the American history, which includes slavery and incarceration of Japanese Americans and Trail of Tears. I mean, all the racist actions that happened in our country. So I don't see things, I guess I should say, I see things as being really connected.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most important thing, how to make that connection, that human connection for people through art. You know, we have to kind of come at it always, talking about it, praying about it, preaching about it,
yes.
performing about it. So I don't know if there's any one particular answer, but that place of reaching one's humanity and rising above all else, and just that we love each other as human beings and we love our planet, that's where we need to
nurture. Thank you. Speaking of different ways in which we reach and touch humanity, Sean, there are other events surrounding the anniversary. I thought you might want to touch upon some of those. You mentioned a partnership with Concordia.
Absolutely. So thanks so much. And thank you, Giselle. Yeah, as Giselle said, you know, we really... Part of this memorial is, you know, there's the sort of intellectual side where we talk about what people can actually do about nuclear weapons, how we can put pressure on our elected representatives to cut funding and get rid of these weapons. So that's the sort of mind part. But then the other part is the heart, which is, I think, really just as important, so that we're engaging people on an emotional level. And I think a great way to do that is art. So one of the things that we've done with Concordia University is co-sponsoring an event, actually, that was just this past Saturday, called Educating for Peace, Poets Respond to the Nuclear Age 70 Years After Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that was a really great event. It included Oregon's current poet laureate, Peter Sears, as well as Kathleen Flinnikin, who is a former Washington State poet laureate and also a former engineer out at Hanford. Hanford is the facility out in Richland, Washington, where the plutonium was created for the bomb that was actually dropped on Nagasaki. So Kathleen has a very personal connection with Hanford and through Hanford to Nagasaki and to the bombings. Also, poet Leah Stinson, who actually works with us on the planning committee for this event, Allison Cobb, and some other poets, and actually including the winner of Oregon PSR's 2015 Greenfield Peace Writing Scholarship, also had an opportunity to read her her winning entry, which was really great to have this young lady who won our scholarship reading with Oregon's poet laureate and Washington's former poet laureate. So it was a really great...
And she was a high school student.
A high school student, right. Yeah, so it was really exciting to just kind of bring this young voice and these older, more established voices in the sort of Northwest poetry scene together and see how they interacted, especially around this theme of nuclear weapons in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And then there's actually another event coming up on August 9th that's an art exhibit also at Concordia University. And this is, we've been working with Concordia University Libraries on this series of events. And that's an art exhibit with Yukio Kawano has done some amazing art. She is, I believe, a third generation Hibakusha whose family was at Hiroshima, I believe, and has created some amazing artwork based around that, some replicas of the bombs, life-sized replicas, using things like kimonos from her family and strands of her own hair, really interesting stuff. So really great art exhibit. And then we've also been engaged working with Peace and Justice Works on a project called the Zones Project. Folks may have seen around town these flyers up on utility poles all around town. The idea behind the Zones Project is to give people a sense of what it would be like if an atomic weapon was dropped on Portland.
Mm-hmm.
So with the Zones Project, we basically say, imagine a 1 megaton bomb being dropped over the Burnside Bridge, And there are these different zones. So in the first couple of zones, you would have 100% loss of life. And then as the zones go out, you would have, you know, these radiation poisoning and things like this. And this zone of death and destruction stretches well beyond the city limits of Portland. So,
well, it even stretches beyond the time that the bomb hits. It stretches into time to the future.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, and I think, you know, especially 70 years, we kind of thought this is an opportunity for us to really use this 70th anniversary to do a lot around Hiroshima and Nagasaki and really bring people's attention to this issue. Because we sort of see it as the sooner we abolish nuclear weapons and the sooner we start really getting serious as world governments and things like that about abolishing these weapons, the sooner the better, because they pose a massive threat to human life and human health and the survival of life on this planet. And the sooner we start getting serious about getting rid of these weapons, the better.
I want to just add, too, that Sean's talking about those zones that were created or would be created if the tonnage of a Hiroshima bomb, but they don't even have those anymore.
Right.
They're like 700 to 1,000 times greater.
Yes.
Than that.
Enough to really abolish anything that we know as life right now. You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. We are speaking with Chisao Hata and Sean Tenney, and we are observing the upcoming 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we encourage your calls to find out not only how you can participate in this aspect, but in political aspects or political action opportunities as well. I have a question.
Our phone numbers.
Thank you. 503-231-8187. I have a question here. When you were talking about artistic installations and then also protest meshed with political action, there was an article I noted that had come up in June, and it was from the Telegraph, the UK Telegraph. And I was curious as to your stand on this, because with regard to this bomb, there is a certain amount of, I guess I'll call it, blindness on the part of the United States. When you talk about how it affects us as human beings here in the States, and how so many people don't even want to address things like the Trail of Tears or slavery. And so there's a U.S. museum project that's coming up, and there's plans here in the States for national parks to commemorate the Manhattan Project atomic bomb program. And there are various Japanese groups who are saying, well, if you do that, put it in the proper context. Look at it as not an act that was absolutely necessary to bring the war to an end, but look at it as a war crime. Any comments on that?
Sean, you, and may I add, Earl, before we began our conversation, Sean was talking somewhat about the misinformation or the misconception of what happened and why it happened.
And how we have that myth that the bomb was necessary
to end the war.
Right. I mean, I think that's pretty much the prevailing narrative. And I would say prevailing narrative in the public discourse is, even among people who understand, which I think most people understand, that nuclear weapons are very dangerous and are a threat. But there's this prevailing idea that, well, yeah, they're bad, but we needed them to end World War II. And this is a very common narrative, and I would say a very common mythology about the end of World War II. And I think that history tells a somewhat different story. I think it is a very controversial thing where a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, this would have happened and that would have happened. And it's a lot of sort of hypothetical situations. But the reality is we're stuck with these weapons. And the sooner we start, I think, looking forward and looking at right now and saying, well, what can we do? We recognize these are incredibly dangerous weapons. We recognize that the possibility of them getting into the wrong hands, which I feel like any hands are the wrong hands for nuclear weapons. It's a growing threat, you know, and the sooner we really address it And I think, you know, it's important to put things in their historical perspective and really look at these. But I think it's right now that we need to kind of focus on what are we doing now about these weapons? And why would we use them again? I mean, we understand that even a limited use of nuclear weapons would cause massive, massive loss of human life. Even they say a limited conflict, say, between India and Pakistan. PSR actually issued a report in 2013 called Nuclear Famine, and that examines the effect of these bombs on the global food supply, and it would lead to an approximate, even with a limited strike with just a few weapons between countries on the other side of the world, would lead to upwards of 2 billion deaths. So I think that's what we need to address right now.
And for those of you who would like, Sean wrote a guest column in the Oregonian talking about the need to ban nuclear weapons. How many, help us get a grasp of how much danger we are in terms of how many weapons are out there, who has them, how threatened are we?
What kind of attitude do these people who possess the weapon have? I mean, when I was younger and I was taking, I was being indoctrinated to our wonderful Air Force, we talked about the threat and the deterrence of nuclear arms,
right.
And that if each side had equal or parity, then they would have a standoff. But that type of mentality has long fled the human race, and people are not afraid to use them and make threats, and that kind of just insanity has gripped much of the human species. You know, to add to what Cecil's saying, where are we?
Well, what you said just then just kind of reminded me of one of my favorite quotes that I think really sums up what's going on with nuclear weapons. I'm not sure the exact wording, but it was a quote by Carl Sagan, who said nuclear weapons are like two sworn enemies standing waist deep in gasoline, one with three matches and one with five. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a pretty good metaphor for what nuclear weapons are, because either way, any one of these weapons being used is going to cause a retaliatory strike. And I think it really speaks to this deeper need to get beyond this kind of, you know, our country versus your country, because these weapons are indiscriminate. Once they start flying, I mean, we're talking global catastrophe. So it doesn't matter if Russia drops a bomb on the United States or the United States drops a bomb on Russia or any other country. It's massive loss of human life on both sides. And I think that kind of undercuts that argument that it's a deterrent, because if either side uses them, you're going to have massive loss of life on both sides. That's just the way these weapons work.
Mutually assured destruction, right. Which does nothing for anyone.
Right. I wanted to speak a little bit to what you had mentioned before, Celeste, about the Manhattan Project, mm-hmm. and its glorification, or are looking at something in the past nostalgically and not looking at the reality. And I think what it's calling for right now is the truth,
yes,
to come out. The truth about a lot of what we have believed is the story or these stories. And from my perspective, I see it happening in a lot of different areas, mm-hmm. of life right now. That the story that we've had or the narrative that we've had has been wrong. And so how do we correct that? Or how do we re-script it? How do we flip that story to include something that was left out?
Mm-hmm. Or, how do we become more inclusive in our understanding of
right.
what happened?
Yeah, and I see that just in a lot of areas, particularly in the American story, mm-hmm. you know, in the American narrative, what is historically what happened? What is nostalgia? What is what we want to believe? What is actually historically, you know, what happened? So I think, you know, those of us that can do that need to sift through that and be able to articulate the other parts. Because if the only story that comes out is the glorification of the Manhattan Project and not the human story. And the human story around personal truth and judgment. I mean, human beings have a choice. We have a choice about everything we do every day, every moment.
Yeah. And so, as Giselle mentioned, you know, there is this human story, and that's part of what we're trying to do with 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the event that we have on Thursday down on the waterfront, is to tell that human side and to tell a perspective that is very personal. And in doing so, we have a couple of great speakers lined up to do that. One is Michiko Kornhauser. Michiko is a hibakusha. She was a child just outside of Hiroshima when the bombs dropped. And as a result of that, her family, Michiko herself and her family have suffered health effects since then. Because this is the kind of weapon that doesn't just go away. It leads to cancers and developmental disorders and all sorts of problems for generations afterwards because just the nature of radiation and it's as a mutagen and things like this. So we've got Michiko speaking as that from that firsthand experience as a hibakusha. And then we have a representative from the Marshall Islands to speak a little bit about the nuclear testing that happened in the Marshall Islands all through the Cold War for years and years, which absolutely decimated the Marshall Islands, which was not an uninhabited island. There were people who lived there.
Right.
And as often with U.S. military policy, we don't really look at the people who live in a place. We just say, oh, you know, that's our nuclear testing ground. It's like, well, yeah, people live there. So the perspective, that perspective as well. And then we're also really fortunate to be joined by Carol Erner, who is a longtime peace and justice activist and anti-nuclear activist and actually one of the original organizers of the Portland commemoration back in the early 60s. So she's been at this for a long time. So she'll be speaking a little bit about sort of the growth of the nuclear abolition movement after the bombings, how it's kind of progressed to now, and what are some of the things that we're actually doing about it, how we're working with other governments to develop international treaties and try to have some of these international treaties actually be binding so that people actually are following the law, because there are international laws that say we need to be, there have been agreements made to cut back on these weapons, and these agreements are often sort of cleverly circumvented by the world's governments.
Well, we also need a body that's going to be strong enough to actually bind somebody, and that's the other part. You know, as we get ready to go to the callers, I do want to say something about the testing in Marshall Islands. It's a horrific thing to think that the United States was just so bold and blatant as to ignore the people who live there, but coupled with that is a type of horrific ignorance of what the bombs were actually going to do. You see pictures of people sitting in chairs to witness it with their sunglasses on, you know, in total ignorance of the power that they were about to unleash. And those people suffered also radiation burns and mutagenic changes in their, you know, in their body that they passed to their children. And so, you know, it's almost worse when you have kind of this ignorance of the power you're playing with, like some really idiot genius child, you know. It's like you don't know what you're doing. And I think if we were really honest with ourselves as a country and as a species, we would step back from the whole idea of nuclear power even as an energy source, because we don't know what we're doing.
I agree. I think it's a technology that the technology developed very quickly.
Very
once
quickly.
It got, you know, and it was some very brilliant minds who were working on the technology. But I would argue that our culture is not at a place that it's able to use these
our
responsibly.
Our species is not our culture. It's our human species is not ready. I can't think of one culture on this planet who could be the safeguard for nuclear weapons. I can't think of one.
Right. You're listening to More Talk Radio on number 503-231-8187. We're speaking about the 70th anniversary of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Our guests today are Sean Tani and Giselle Hatter. And we would like your calls and your comments. So we'll go to George. Thank you for waiting, George. Good morning.
Thank you very much, and a wonderful subject, and one that is, frightening, considering the long record of cover-up and lies that had been told to the people of Japan in the years immediately following and probably ever since. And I wanted to mention one book I read because of KBOO, and by a woman who worked for the nuclear industry for a number of years. Her name is Stephanie Cook, and the title of her book is In Mortal Hands, A Cautionary History of the Nuclear Age. And she mentions that the not just the bombings in Japan, but the entire industry, and then the bombings in Japan, were permeated by a culture of cover-up and telling the public phony stories about, bombs, that was it, the bombs explosion, you know. And it wasn't very long before a few Japanese scientists got together and they realized what had happened, and they realized the effects were not going to end in a few days or weeks, but would go on for years. And then Cook mentioned something else, which is, I think, kind of interesting. She says, and this is on page 134 in her book, In Mortal Hands, the atomic establishments in both countries, Britain and France, presented their sunnier side to the public while deceiving it about the true purpose of the earlier nuclear reactors, which was to produce plutonium for bombs. And then in other parts of the book, she points out that it was well understood in France and in, I think, in the U.S., that nuclear power was not going to be the low danger and technology easy to master. It was going to be very expensive and very dangerous, but the nuclear products were wanted for weapons. So I just wondered, have we gotten out of the cover-up yet? Are not the Japanese people and the American people and all people in this planet still being kept in the dark by their, by our experts? So that's a question to you guys.
That's a great question. Thank you.
Thank you, George.
So much.
Oh, well, I would say, particularly with regard to nuclear energy, yes, which, yeah, the nuclear energy industry is a byproduct of the nuclear weapons industry. They're very much tied in with each other. In fact, it's a lot of the same companies and investors, and always has been. And so, yes, I would think, to answer your question, George, as clearly as I can, yes, I think there is a lot of dishonesty about the safety and security of nuclear power around the globe. One of the things that Oregon PSR is doing is working to shutter the last remaining commercial nuclear power plant in the Pacific Northwest, which is the Columbia Generating Station, which, ironically enough, is out at the Hanford Nuclear Facility, already the most contaminated, polluted place in the Western Hemisphere, site of the world's largest cleanup and most expensive environmental cleanup in the world. And the reason that Hanford and the Richland area in Richland, Washington, on the Columbia River, just a few hours from Portland, is the most contaminated site in the Western Hemisphere is because that's where the plutonium for a lot of America's nuclear weapons arsenal was produced. So I think this goes back to something that Celeste mentioned earlier, this sort of idea that nuclear weapons don't only kill people when they're used. They kill people through the entire process. As soon as the uranium is mined, we have a cycle of death that starts. And it continues even when the bombs aren't used. And I think, you know, regionally, this is a really important issue because there are a lot of people in the Tri-Cities areas around Hanford who we call the Hanford downwinders. And these are people who suffered severe medical consequences from the pollution that is a direct result of our weapons production. So we've killed a lot of Americans with these weapons, as well as obviously a lot of folks around the world.
And we'll continue killing them.
I wanted
to respond.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask if you guys know some very good books or articles, and I want to mention one that I discovered a few years ago, published by MIT Press. This is about the deception of the people near the testing grounds in Nevada, and it does not talk about the Marshall Islanders, but in another book I read that some of the Marshall Islanders were convinced that it was not ignorance on the part of our military, that they wanted to use those Marshall Islanders as guinea pigs. And in the book I am going to mention, it's called American Ground Zero. by Carol Gallagher, published back in 1984 or so. And she, in her book, suggests from remarks she found in interviewing some of the people who were working at the test site and soldiers and scientists, that some of them were convinced that they too were being used as guinea pigs by the military to see what the radiation exposures would do to them. So that's, if you have some books to mention, I'd be very interested. And I'll hang up and listen on the line to this. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your call.
I'm sorry, I don't have any specific books, but I know that on our website with PSR, and those will have links to other information. They're out there. I wanted to mention just a little bit back to the idea that everything is connected and we're all connected, that the Hanford nuclear plant is the same model as the one in Fukushima. And as we have seen over the years that have passed since the Fukushima disaster, and in fact still going on,
yes,
disaster, we here in the Pacific Northwest have, you know, suffered the effects quietly, but they've been there. You know, we had the debris wash up on our shores in the ocean, but, you know, we've had nuclear physicists who have also been looking at the levels of radiation in Portland, Oregon. And also, as Sean has mentioned, the Hibakusha, or the survivors of the atomic war, atomic age, the Hibakushas are not only Japanese, but the downwinders in Colombia. Mm-hmm. And that area where Hanford is also, they built it on a fault.
The Columbia Generating Station, yeah, the nuclear power plant out there, there's a host of problems. I mean, it is a GE Mark II reactor, the Columbia Generating Station, same design that failed at Fukushima. And, you know, obviously there's not quite the same tsunami risk, but there are considerable seismic risk to that generating station that were not really understood very well.
Oh, you mean like the fact we're in the Pacific Ring of Fire?
Well, yeah, just
in it's on the Columbia River.
Thank you.
Yeah, and so, you know, Hanford is a huge issue. It's already, as I said, the most contaminated place in the Western Hemisphere. So we think, why add to that with a very inefficient, very expensive, very dangerous, very insecure nuclear power plant in our region when we can easily offset that energy in more responsible and safer ways?
You're listening to More Talk Radio. We're speaking this morning with guests who are speaking about the continuing impact of nuclear weapons and nuclear energy, and want to encourage you to participate at the 70th year after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the ever-present nuclear threat event, which will take place on Thursday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza in Portland. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. We have a few callers online, so let's go to Miriam. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, and thanks for having this show. Hi, Sean. I'm so glad that this show is happening right now. I wanted to let people know even more about the Columbia Generating Station and nuclear power. And when we talk about what happened in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and we talk about nuclear weapons, I feel that we always have to include nuclear power as a nuclear weapon.
Yes.
Because nuclear power plants are nuclear weapons that are constantly going off. We just don't see big flashes in the sky. What we do see are rises in cancers around nuclear power plants, not just from the Hanford downwinders. That was primarily from Hanford itself. But with the Columbia Generating Station, which you've been talking about, and thank you for that, we're also seeing rises in cancers in that area. And I know that Dr. Ian Fairley just put out another report on the rise of cancers among people in close proximity to nuclear power plants, and the rise of leukemias from workers in nuclear power plants. And one of the things that I want to do as a co-founder of No Nukes Northwest is show people through an article that I'm working on right now. We just had a closure at the Columbia Generating Station for refueling, and it started on May 9th. And one of the things that I just put together were charts of radiation releases from the EPA graphs and the NRC event pages. When there's an event, it's a problem at a nuclear power plant, and it means something has gone wrong. When those events take place, there are times when radiation is released, and we don't necessarily know unless we know how to find where, when did those releases happen and did they happen. I believe that I have now located that, and there's an article that's going to come out in Counterpunch, hopefully by Friday of this week, to show everybody what these releases look like and how affected the communities are from nuclear power plants. And I guess that's really what I wanted to add to the conversation, that when we talk about nuclear weapons, we have to talk about nuclear power plants as a nuclear weapon.
Yes, I agree.
Thank you, Miriam.
Thanks, Miriam.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll go to Leslie.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask Sean if PSR has done research on the effects of depleted uranium and its impact on the people in Iraq and on the American military. Thanks.
It's definitely depleted uranium, I think, is a great example of a nuclear weapon that we use on a regular basis. It's not often considered a nuclear weapon. Usually when we think of nuclear weapons, we think of this Hiroshima and Nagasaki, this big mushroom cloud. But depleted uranium absolutely is a nuclear weapon. It's been used in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the former Yugoslavia. And it's really a technology that is, I would say, morally unacceptable technology. It's uranium is used to coat munitions so that they are increases their armor-piercing capability. And so, you know, shells are shot and they go through a tank and then they just kind of are in the desert and they're in the soil and they contaminate the soil and they sicken people for generations because this is radioactive material that's used in these depleted uranium munitions. And certainly they affect for, you know, years and generations to come the places that they're used, the soldiers who fire them. You know, this is material that, again, is inherently destructive to human health. That's what radioactive material does. It causes all sorts of problems in living tissue, the cells of living tissue. So yes, absolutely, depleted uranium should be considered a nuclear weapon. And there is some really great research out there tying some of the effects of some of the health effects for U.S. veterans who were in the Gulf War, for example, to some of the a lot of the health effects that veterans coming back, we can trace those to radiation-related illnesses. So I think it's something that certainly our military doesn't acknowledge, that these are weapons that not only are we using against innocent people for generations to come in the places that we use them, but we're also using them against our own troops.
Thank you.
And deny responsibility.
And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Vernon.
You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for this discussion. My father trained pilots in World War II, including the pilots who dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, as well as the firebombers of Tokyo and Dresden and the many horrific bombings of World War II. And he suffered with a guilty conscience for years, trying to figure out how he could make amends for the horrors that he had participated in. He was a follower of Linus Pauling and the many scientists, including Albert Einstein, who spoke out against the use of nuclear weapons ever and actually said that the lesson of this is that we can't afford to fight war anymore. I myself was arrested at Hanford for civil disobedience 30 years ago. This struggle goes on, and still our country is bombing more people around the world on a daily basis than any country ever has. It makes no sense at all. How do we turn the tide on this?
Great question.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I think part of it is an acknowledgement, and thank you so much for that, and thank you for your civil disobedience. I think it's an important part of this movement, this struggle to get rid of these weapons and the associated technologies with them. But I think the first step really is acknowledgement. It's acknowledging why we fight wars and divorcing it from this idea that we're doing it really to keep ourselves safe. That's just not accurate. I mean, really, I think we're engaged in so many conflicts around the world because war is good business. You know, I mean, it's A huge part of the American economy is producing weapons and selling weapons. So I think we need to fully understand that the reason that, and not just the United States, obviously, I mean, a lot of the world's military powers, you know, there's an economic reason for this more so than any sort of safety or security or promoting democracy or fighting terrorism or any of the sort of jargon that we use to describe why we're doing what we're doing. Really, a lot of it boils down to the fact that somebody's making money off of it. I think acknowledging that is very important.
I very much agree with you that it is about, it's about economic short-term profits. It's not good business. My father actually was a very good businessman, and one of the things he taught me is that you succeed by helping everyone you're engaged with to succeed. And a competitive business model that relies on causing suffering in others is short-sighted and will not last.
Yeah, and I think that short-sightedness is the key.
It may take out all of humanity in the process.
I wanted to also thank you for your action 30 years ago, because those actions still make a difference. And I think we need to look at the role of civil disobedience and continue to redefine it. And I think that the Shell Greenpeace action that just happened is a great example, and it's young people.
Yeah, including our awesome executive director, Kelly Campbell, who was out in her kayak as part of that Shell No protest.
But so. Those acts of civil disobedience speak loudly that we do not agree. And so we have to be willing to take those actions and to think of creative ways to act as if the world is the way we want it to be. I think not only to, you know, say stop this, but I know that some of the actions, I've been involved with the Ground Zero program up at Bangor in Poulsbo, Washington. And a lot of the actions that started many years ago was, you know, we're going to go have a picnic on the land over there. It just happens to have military all around it. But we should be able to do that. We should be able to take our family over there and have a picnic and, you know, boat in the water there. And that act of civil disobedience, while it, you know, seemed like a nice thing to do, you know, kayaking seems like a nice thing to do. It says, this is the world, this is how the world should look.
Right.
This is the way we're going to invest in the way that we want our world to be.
You know, one of the things I want to say as we wrap up is that I think looking at the desire to pursue nuclear power, nuclear arms, nuclear energy is not necessarily solely an economic pursuit. I think we need to look at it from a different model. I think we need to look at it as we are starting to do with things like racism. It's a mental illness in that one of the things human beings can possess is hubris, this out of proportion arrogance that we can control. And it's like being able to control the wild lions as a tamer or have the biggest beast of a dog, you know. I think what makes a lot of people pursue nuclear energy is this fallacy that they can control it. Because when you think of how many other things we as human beings attempt to do, because we have this conquering spirit in us, I see this unending pursuit of a power that is beyond our comprehension to be not just childish, but childishly dangerous. And when it continues like this, and the more recent episode we've had with trying to tame it and make it a domesticated entity was at Fukushima. And we still haven't learned our lesson. We haven't. We paint weapons with it to make them more deadly. We try to make energy for it to warm our baby's formula. You know, we try to find ways to excuse the deaths that have happened in other places and collateral damage. And I think to be successful as we conquer person by person by person, we need to rethink our model and look at it as a kind of illness, a hubris.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, certainly the use of nuclear weapons and a lot of the sort of militarism around the world, I think, is definitely pathological in nature. It's something that is counter to our long-term survival, and I think it needs to be identified as that and looked at as pathological behavior. And then if it is indeed a pathological behavior, if it is indeed a disease, then what is the cure and what is the treatment for it? And I think things like this 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki that we're doing on Thursday is a, you know, it's a step in the right direction for acknowledging that there is a cure for this pathology.
My recent trip to Cuba really convinced me to have a more positive outlook on humanity, because I was feeling pretty desperate. Yes. And not very positive at all. And to hear people say that their really core value is that human beings come first.
Yes.
Humanity comes first. Not the dollar, not how, you know, we make money, not who gets ahead, but as human beings, humans to humans, you know, that is what is the most important.
Right. As we head towards the close of this program, I want to give the opportunity to once more share about the events this week, how people might get in touch or become involved in activities that people such as you find people are doing.
Yeah, so we certainly encourage folks to come out on Thursday. Again, it's 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the ever-present nuclear threat. It's on Thursday, August 6th at 6 o'clock. It's at the Japanese American Historical Plaza down on the Portland waterfront at Cooch Street, and we definitely encourage folks to come out. Here are speakers, here are performers, including Portland Taiko, awesome drummers, and get involved in some of the efforts that we're doing to support the humanitarian pledge to ban nuclear weapons and encourage our government to sign that pledge and join that pledge and actually live up to it. And for more information about it, people can check out our website. That's just www.oregonpsr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter.
And to Sal, you mentioned about going to Cuba and how that gave you some hope. And I think one of the things I appreciate about you is as an artist, you touched us not only with our head, but in our hearts. And are you encouraged by your work with children that we can change the way we are doing things?
I think that's one of the main reasons why I continue to teach children, that we need to teach them. It's not a given. You know, we don't just assume that they know things. We have to make sure that they have, you know, pictures of history that might not be the good history, but it's history. And what the truth is in terms of what's happened to people, not only in America and the world. So yes, I think it's our obligation. And as an educator, I think it's my obligation to not only protect and inform them, but to inspire their creativity and imagination. And that way, if we have human beings that have those qualities that are strong within them, they'll be able to say, this isn't right. There's nothing about this that is right. And what can I do? How can I be informed? How can I educate myself? And then how can I get involved?
Thank you so much, DeSalle and Sean, for joining us this morning. And you might get involved this Thursday by going to the Japanese American Historical Plaza and being a witness at the 70th memorial of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That takes place this Thursday, August 6th at 6 p.m. You've been listening to More Talk Radio with Celeste Carey and myself, Cecil Prescott. We thank you for listening, and we will speak with you next week.
Thank you, Cecil. Thank you.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the Challenging Corporate Rule and Creating Democracy event with David Cobb, Sunday, August 9th, 7 to 9 p.m., doors at 6:30 p.m., at the First Unitarian Church, B102, at Southwest 12th and Salmon Street, Portland, Oregon, sponsored by the Alliance for Democracy, Move to Amend Portland, Economic Justice Action Group of the First Unitarian Church, the Pachamama Alliance, and KBOO. Move to Amend spokesperson David Cobb is coming to Portland, and he's going to talk to you to join the growing effort to abolish the doctrines of corporate constitutional rights and money as speech. And doors will open at 6:30 p.m.
Tune in to the podcast Probable Cause This on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/probablecause. On this podcast, I look at the top stories on the lack of accountability for police and public officials in Oregon and across the country. That's kboo.fm/probablecause for a weekly roundup of stories on holding our public officials accountable to we the people.
This is a good old song called I Wish I Was a Mole in the Ground. Sometimes you ain't what you think you want to be, but dadgummit, be satisfied, because you ain't what you don't want to be, and if you ain't what you don't want to be, you don't want to be something you ain't. That's good English for you, boy. This boy got it so bad, he said he wished he was a mole in the ground. He got it bad. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground.